All right. Welcome back to Journalistic Integrity. It is Tuesday, October 11th, and I am in a fantastic mood because the Kansas City Chiefs won one of the most intense regular season games the Chiefs have played in the past decade. They beat the Raiders 30-29. I'm going to talk about that, give my insights and observations on that game, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about the New York Mets, who were eliminated from the playoffs a few days ago, and have my final words on the Mets season. But let's start with the Monday Night Football game. Chiefs win 30-29 in an absolute thriller against the division rival Oakland Raiders. And, you know, I feel like every person has this with their team, is you kind of notice something at the beginning of the game and you're like, oh, this something feels off. Maybe in baseball, it's if the star pitcher throws two straight balls to start the game, you're like, oh, this guy doesn't have it. For the Chiefs, whenever they play a home game, especially a home night game, and the game starts with the smoke still on the field for whatever pregame activities, fire stuff was going on, whenever there's smoke on the field, the Chiefs always get off to a slow start. And so I saw that. I was like, great. And sure enough, Raiders jump out to a 17-0 lead, including a 4th-and-1 gutsy call, deep pass to Davante Adams. And it's a great play call. But what we're not going to hear about after this game is the third down play. The Chiefs had the ball carrier, it might have been Jacobs, corralled for like a 3-yard gain and would have made it like 4th-and-6. Instead, and this was a theme throughout the game, the Chiefs were unable to tackle ball carriers. Instead of it being 4th-and-5, in which they probably punt, he gets it to a 4th-and-1, they go for it, touchdown. You look up, it's 17-0. And even with Mahomes at quarterback, the doubt starts to creep in. It's like the complete inverse of how the Chiefs started against the Buccaneers on Sunday night happened on Monday night. Look up, it's 17-0, then 17-7. Then the big roughing the passer call happens. It's an awful call. The refs have come out and had a statement. They're like, hey, he didn't brace the fall. This is the right call. So they're not even walking it back. But it's so roughing the passer is so different. If you, A, hit a guy after he throws the ball, B, sack a guy, but then there's another level where you sack the guy, have the ball, and then you just hit him. Chris Jones had the ball. He's basically a ball carrier, and he had full control. It wasn't like they both had their hands on the ball. Chris Jones had the ball. He fell on him. The ref said, even if that's true, if Chris Jones had full possession of the ball, it's still roughing the passer. And so it's an awful call, but there's this line between, is it a bad call or is it a bad rule? The more I hear the refs talking about it, reading the rule book, it's like, that might have been the right call, which is almost worse because it just shows the prevailing rule throughout all NFL games is if you sack the quarterback and you land on him, you do not completely brace his fall, it's going to be a flag. So I'd be much more upset if the Chiefs lost this game. That was on a third down. The Chiefs would have had the ball. Instead, Raiders get a field goal, 20-7. Then the Chiefs bailed out by a Raiders face mask into the first half. They're able to get into field goal range, kick a field goal, who, by the way, their kicker missed the field goal earlier. Every single extra point was either off the post or just hugging that left post line. He missed the field goal, too, that was that he pulled left. But then he drills a 59-yarder. And those 3 points ended up being huge. So it's 20-10 going into halftime. And so a half of football, you feel like, hey, I've got a lot of time. But what I'm slowly learning about the game of football is you only have so many, you have a fixed number of possessions. The Chiefs only had 4 possessions in the second half, entering with 10 points. The Raiders end up scoring 29. So the Chiefs had to score 3 touchdowns, at least, in their 4 possessions to win. That's what they do. They go touchdown, 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 and then the punt at the very end, which we'll get to in a second. A lot of this came down to short yardage plays. So many different spots in this game came down to 2nd and short, 3rd and short, 3rd and goal, 4th and short, 2-point convert. It was all over. Two of Kelce's touchdown passes came on third and goal. You think if they miss one of those, maybe the Chiefs kick a field goal, maybe they don't convert at all. Any of those plays don't happen, and they settle for a field goal or don't convert, the Raiders win. We had 2 2-point conversion tries, which I actually agreed with both of them, and this was not like some Brandon Staley nonsense where he chooses not to punt it to Jacoby Brissett with no timeouts and like a minute left. 2-point conversions were the right call. So the Chiefs, they had a struggling kicker, and I'm surprised teams don't do this more where you score a touchdown, so it's a 7-point game. But if you go for two and you get it, you make it a 2-possession game. It was the right call. Chiefs don't convert. Oakland gets a good pass rush. Oakland comes back, or Las Vegas comes back, scores a touchdown. They go for two, and it was the right play call. The Chiefs had not been able to stop Jacobs all night, and he just comes up an inch short, which, by the way, we give the refs a lot of crap, rightfully so. That was an incredible call on the field to somehow see his knee down in that scrum with like 12 players right in the middle. Then the Chiefs are unable to convert on a second and short and third and short that would have basically run out the clock if they get that first down, or made it really tough for the Raiders. And then Andy Reid decides to punt. And it was one of those moments where it was like a fourth and two, like the 45. And I was like, okay, you know, I don't hate this punt. I kind of want us to go for it. Our offense has been great. We've scored 3 straight touchdowns. But if we pin them, I'm like, okay, they got to drive 50 yards. If we miss, don't get it. They just have to get a first down. Carlson, their kicker, is automatic. So I didn't hate it, but I knew. I was like, if this punt goes in the end zone, it's my biggest pet peeve ever. It's like, I would rather you kick it too short and kick it like to the 25 than just bomb it into the end zone. Punters do that way too often. So I was like, if this goes into the end zone, the Chiefs are going to lose. The Raiders just have to get, you know, 40 yards, a couple first downs, and they're going to be in field goal range. Great punt to about the 6 or 7 yard line. And if you're a Raiders fan, you're probably feeling pretty good because they've been able to drive the ball. They moved the ball down. Third and short. Another third and short. A little wheel route to Devontae Adams. It's in his hands. Looks like he catches it. Chiefs people on the sidelines are saying, no, he didn't catch it. Refs come down. Say he caught it. Then we go to replay, and there's a slight bobble, and Devontae Adams catches this ball cleanly 1,000 out of 1,000 times. But for whatever reason, he bobbles it slightly, is only able to get 1 foot in. They're left to a fourth and short. And keep in mind, they could have run the ball on third and short, picked up that first down, and then only needed another 10 yards to get in range. Fourth and short, Chiefs go, press coverage, bring 8 defenders. I think we blitzed 8 guys. And Adams and Renfro end up running into each other. It's a great no call. No Chiefs guys touched him. But it just shows what press coverage can do to receivers. You reroute them. They're not on the same line that they worked on in practice. Their timing is slightly off between Renfro running the corner route and Devontae Adams running the streak kind of seam. All of that's thrown off once you get hands on a receiver. And that's what the Chiefs did. It was a gutsy call. You had a feeling the Raiders were going to go deep because they did it to Devontae Adams in the first quarter. They knew the Chiefs were going to blitz, and somehow, some way, the Chiefs escape with a win. What a game. And so we look at the Raiders. They're 1-4. They've lost a bunch of close games. But let's not count out the Raiders. Listen to this stretch. This has got to be one of the easiest stretches the next month and a half that the Raiders have. They've got the Texans, the Saints, the Jaguars, the Colts, the reeling Broncos, and then Seattle. Those are 6 really winnable games. If they go 5-1, all of a sudden they're 6-5 and really gunning for that last AFC wildcard spot. But what a Monday night game. So exciting, nerve-wracking. The Chiefs pull it out, 4-1. There's no real teams that have separated themselves. The Chiefs have shown some struggle. The Bills, and then the NFC, the Packers take a step back. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers don't look great. The Rams, the defending champs, look awful. They can't block anybody. Stafford can't throw to anybody but Kupp. But quietly, my team that I picked out of the NFC, the 49ers are starting to gain steam. They've got a quarterback that's been there. They've got a coach that's been there. They've got a fantastic roster and weapons, offense and defensive line. Fred Warner in the middle of that defense, one of the most fun defensive players to watch. Watch out for the 49ers to reel off a stretch of wins right here in October and November and try and get that one seed in the NFC. That's enough football. Let's talk some baseball. My New York Mets, the 101 win New York Mets, lose at home in the wild card round to the San Diego Padres. And I feel like every fan, especially in baseball, after a 162 game season, after the final game your team plays, whether you lose, it's that 162nd game, you don't make the playoffs, or you lose in the playoffs, or you even win the World Series, after that final out is made, every fan that was kind of in tune with the team throughout the year, it's been this really long journey, every fan has this moment where you take a step back, you take a couple deep breaths, and you're like, what did this mean? What did all of these games, this throughout the summer, throughout the spring, into August and September and October, how do I make sense of this season? So after that final out, you know, you kind of take some breaths and you're like, okay, what, how do I make sense of this? So many games, like, what did all this mean? And eventually you come to a single word or phrase. And after the last out against the Padres on Sunday night, the overwhelming word, phrase, was A, disappointing, and B, just empty calories, empty wins, 101 wins. The Mets won the third most games, not in the NL, in all of Major League Baseball. More wins than the Yankees. And when you look at the Mets team, they had two of the top five leaders in RBIs in all of the majors, Lindor and Alonso. Alonso had the same amount of RBIs, 131, as Aaron Judge, the home run king, one of the best offensive seasons of all time. Alonso had the same amount of RBIs as he did. The Mets also had the batting champion, and he was not Lindor Alonso. He is a third player in that lineup, Jeff McNeil, who had the best batting average in all of. And it doesn't stop there. The Mets have two of the best starting pitchers in all of the MLB in Jacob deGrom and Max Scherzer. And they were both healthy for this playoff series. And oh yeah, they also have the best, or tied for the best, with the guy in Cleveland, closer in all of majors, in Edwin Diaz. And so you have all of these ingredients. You've got like seven A-plus players on the team, and the Mets go down with a whimper. I mean, the game three, the Mets never challenged the Padres. There's never a rally where the fans are all on their feet and it's, you know, first and second with one out, you know, down 4-0 in the sixth inning, but you've got Alonso coming. There's nothing like that. It was Musgrove just shoved it down our throats, and it reminded me of these Mets Braves games from, you know, 10, 15 years ago, where Tim Hudson, this game would be like an afternoon, you know, Sunday game. Tim Hudson, every single time, would go 7 innings, 3 hits, 1 earned run against the Mets. Every single time. And that's what Musgrove's outing. And I should have seen this coming in two ways. Number one, during the game, and if you watch a lot of baseball, have a team that you root for, you know this. When a game starts and your guys are hitting it hard, but right at somebody early, then you do it again like the third inning, fourth and fifth, and you're just like, oh, this is one of those days where we're going to hit it right at an outfielder, right at Grisham, right at Soto and right field, warning track multiple times, and it just stinks, and that's just baseball. But secondly, I was so close to being out on this team. I was actually like, in Mets Twitter, there's something called cancel the season, where basically you're like, I'm emotionally removing myself from the Mets so they can't hurt me, But then if they win the World Series, I'm not going to get as much gratification and fulfillment because I kind of removed myself from the team. After that Braves sweep, which for all purposes eliminated the Mets for winning the division and getting a bye out of the wild card, I was like, okay, I'm done with this team. They lose game one to the Padres. I'm like, great decision. Great job canceling. Not going to get sucked back in. Then the Mets respond in game two. Despite DeGrom getting knocked around a little bit, they bounce back, and I was fully back in. I was like, oh my gosh, win or go home game at home. We're going to win this game, and I do not want to be removed from this team because we're going to go on a playoff run. And then it just completely backfired in my face. And to make matters even worse, the Mets have a bunch of free agents. DeGrom's coming up, Diaz, Brandon Nimmo, our leadoff hitter, a couple other guys. So the team might look a little different. Seth Lugo, another good reliever. To make matters worse, the next day, the Braves sign Strider, their really good young pitcher, to an incredible deal. And I feel like what the Braves are doing, you know, it's getting some publicity, but I feel like it's really revolutionary what they're doing, and that, you know, in baseball, you've got to play in the majors for a really long period of time before you can get that long contract. And what the Braves are saying is, hey, guys, we won't let you wait this long. We'll give you money right now. It's probably not going to be anywhere close to how much you would get in free agency a few years down the road, but we'll trade. We'll give you, you know, a bunch of money. And so these players are like, you know, we're making nothing. We're hitting, you know, 25 home runs. We've got a sub-3 ERA. We want to make some money. And they're like, okay, you know, maybe we'll get a big second contract, but we'll sign a contract now. I'll become a multi-millionaire right now and have any injury concerns pushed away because I'll get this money guaranteed. And when you look at that Braves roster and how long they have these guys signed, it's scary. And the Braves are in a perfect position, and the Mets just aren't. They've got so many question marks. And it just, as a Mets fan, you know, the future, we've got Steve Cohen, and so we know we can get players in New York, but even signing big time players, you never know how they're going to do in New York. We saw it with Jason Bay and countless other players come to New York, and last thing I learned about this series is not all 7 through 9 hitters are created equal, even if they have the same statistics. Not all 230 hitters who hit, let's say, 15 home runs for 70 RBIs are created the same. And we saw this in the Mets and Padres. The Mets 7 through 9 hitters were just having uncompetitive at-bats. Meanwhile, the Padres, with Grisham, who's a, I think, sub-200 hitter, Kim, their shortstop, Nola, their catcher, were having great, scrappy, big RBI at-bats, two-out RBI at-bats. And it got me thinking, you know, some 7 through 9 hitters, like the ones on the Mets, they may have the same batting average as the guys on the Padres, but they can't hit really good pitching, which is what you're going to face in the playoffs. And it really changes things when you can get a couple of those guys on base and it flips to the top of the order. You've got the pitcher working out of the stretch against Lindor and Alonso, and it just changes things than it being, you know, two outs, nobody on, going from the stretch, can throw all my pitches. And the Padres' bottom of the lineup was not fazed at all by DeGrom, Scherzer, or any of the Mets pitchers. All right, that's it for today's episode. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Be back in a few days. See ya.